future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey, everybody, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Yes, it is once again another episode of Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is Monday, August 23rd, 2021. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts right from our own backyards and from across the country. On Fridays, you all know it, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And you can check out the Wednesday show. The Wednesday show with Cyril Michalako. You know Cyril? He's a progressive columnist from the Bucks County Courier-Times, the Intelligencer. He joins me to drill down into Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and international politics. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can help support this show. Like you know, you don't have to wait. You can just do this right now, right? Seriously. By becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month at patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show on the Podbean app as a podcast, you can hit that little patron button right up top, too. You can also help out this show by heading over to our YouTube channel, if you're not there already, and smash that subscribe button, like the stream for this show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live. Yes, we are broadcasting live on Riverside.fm. You can also join us at Riverside.fm kind of at the end of the show. And if you want to call in, you got any kind of listener comments and things like this, we'll do this after the break, right? This is what I failed to mention to Ben ahead of time. He can stick around for the afterward, or he can kind of take off and enjoy his evening out there in Las Vegas. You know, that's all up to him. We can see there. Also remind you can join our Discord server. All the details are right there in the show notes. For more progressive PA-based talk, you can tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern, YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, wherever you stream something, you can find Rick at 9 p.m. And you can check out the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV on Saturdays. And he's got the new show out of WBAI out of New York, which is fantastic. Get all the details, head on over to thericksmithshow.com for all the latest across all his platforms. And you know I'm going to say it, you got to check out the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Yeah, the amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Yes, that's right. You got to watch out for that. You got to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus. That's at The Night Caucus on Twitter. Make sure you subscribe to their podcast, Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And yes, gamers, you a gamer? Check out The Game Inn. That's with two N's. The Game Inn, it's a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, like their family, right? Raise my son's best friend. So get on over there if you're looking for something. You know, make sure that you they check out their retro N64s, Nintendo N64s. You can check out platforms, any platform that you possibly want. They've got it there. They've got collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, you name it. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn with two N's. That's at The Game Inn on Twitter. If you're looking for something special, something that's hard to find, you can drop them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com. And a special shout out, as always, goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongOfDayMan. That's at SongOfDayMan on Twitter. Well, we got a really, really good show for you tonight. I've been looking forward to this ever since that Ben said, hey, we're gonna do this, right? This week's episode, I'm talking with Ben Tupper about the crisis unfolding in Afghanistan. It seems that the news is like changing as fast as we can keep up with it, as fast as the Taliban swept across the country, like meeting little resistance. And even just today, we saw the U.S. military has recommended that Biden decide by tomorrow whether or not to extend the deadline to evacuate folks from this, you know, original August 31st deadline. So things are moving quickly. Right. And this is a critical point in Biden's presidency and also how we understand kind of like, you know, the role of kind of like the U.S. and kind of a global involvement. Now, Ben Tupper served in the United States military for 20 years. He was part of Task Force Phoenix in Afghanistan for a year-long tour. He's responsible for mentoring, training, and fighting alongside the Afghan National Army. Ben retired in 2015 at the rank of major. Ben had previously visited and worked in Afghanistan as part of a program to support the education of girls and women. Ben has a long history of involvement in progressive organizations working nationally and internationally to combat injustice on economic, gender, and racial fault lines. These include work and studies in Nicaragua, Cuba, Costa Rica during the 1980s and 1990s. And Ben remains a strong supporter of democratic movements, organizations, and processes, and currently enjoys talking politics over good cigars and IPAs in Las Vegas and Syracuse, New York. And full disclosure here, when Ben, you know, says he got this start like 1980s and 1990s, that's when I first met Ben. Ben and I were in college together in Syracuse, and we're known for doing things like, you know, setting up shanty towns on the campus quad and going in and staging, fake kidnappings, right, in support of, you know, getting the U.S. out of funding death squads in El Salvador, right? So there's you go. Ben, man, welcome to the show.
The good old days. You bring back some good memories there. Guerrilla theater is always where it's at. It's always where it's at. Screw YouTube. It's not YouTube. Screw Twitter. Go out and do some guerrilla theater, man. But anyways, it's a pleasure to talk with you and be here. I know I form a kind of strange intersection, although if you're in the military, you realize it's not that strange. There are a lot of progressive people who are in today's United States Armed Forces. It's not the kind of lockstep conservative cauldron that I thought it was and that I'm sure it used to be for the further back in time you go, but there are a lot of progressives there. There are a lot of critical thinkers there. And I've enjoyed the experience, my career in the military. I've met a lot of good people. And I like to think I did some good things. But at the same time, I also am not foolish enough to think that, you know, Uncle Sam is the savior of the world and that guns are the way to solve problems. And I think that what we see today in Afghanistan kind of speaks to that truth. Is that even with good intentions, sometimes you create a worse situation when you resort to what we like to call boomsticks, you know, just the use of kinetic power to solve your problems usually blows up in your face. And I think you could say that's kind of where we're at today with Afghanistan.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. And, you know, one point that you bring up there, too, and, you know, we've talked about this like over God in so many years periodically. You know, one of the in many ways, one of the worst things that happened in the 1960s, you go way back then, was a split between the working class movements, right, and the left and the kind of the military. I mean, this is one thing that I remember you saying, got it for as long as I remember your involvement in the military was always like, look, this is like working class America. Right. And, you know, the left in many ways, it had kind of like just handed over the discourse. Right. I mean, handed over the kind of recruitment about patriotism, involvement in country and things. And that's been, and I see that like kind of like you're referring to there. That's shifting a bit, it seems, of late. But still, I mean, I think that's really kind of one of these critical junctures why it's so important to have, I think, a really nuanced understanding of what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just know, like, for me, when I was younger, anybody who was in the military, like instantly I couldn't relate. And I learned from my service that that was a huge mistake. And I think you just spoke to that, that the military is made up primarily of lower income people, people of color. If you go rip open the box of MREs, the meals ready to eat, like there's vegan meals in there now. And there's a reason for that. You know, it's because there's a lot of people who are like, I don't want to eat animals who join the military, you know? So anyways.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. So Ben, so really, I mean, like I said this to you before is, you know, as soon as things started breaking in Afghanistan and I was watching things unfold, especially with the rapid advance of the Taliban and everything is like, I immediately thought, man, you know, Ben's the person I want to talk to about this and see if we get him on in part because I said this to you before the show too, I just had to shut off the media. When I was watching people's hot takes, basically about what's going on and who's to blame. And it was a pretty nuanced, it wasn't just either or Democrat Republicans. It was like, you know, kind of neoliberal security state folks. And it was New American Century folks. And it was, you know, all these kind of divisions and fractions across the parties that were doing these hot takes. And I'm like, all I'm thinking about is like, holy crap, is like, they're getting overran by the Taliban. I was, you know, we're watching female journalists have been breaking news, like have been doing this amazing reporting over the years. And now they're like running for their lives. Right. And I said, look, we just got to have like get away from the hot takes and kind of get a sense of what's happening on the ground. And I just really want to kind of get your kind of your takeaways from where we sit right now and what's going on.
All right. So I'm going to jump off of the, you use the term hot take. And I think if you boil down American culture or Western European, the nations that for the most part put blood and money into Afghanistan, and you compare that to Afghan culture and history, and hot take is a great, I guess, metaphor for how we are inclined to be like, let's fix it now. Let's do this now. Let's throw money at it now. Let's just bomb it now. And then everything will be good tomorrow and we win. Whereas the Afghan people and history is one of just slow. There's no rush here. And there's a quote, and I forget who said it, and it's been said a million times, so I apologize. It's kind of trite, but the Afghans have a saying like, how's it go? You have all the watches, but we have all the time. And like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we'd all sit around and go, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, but our watches kick ass, so we're not, you can have all the time you need, you're going to lose. And over time, damn, didn't that quote play out perfectly accurately? They have all the time because they're patient, because there's no need for a hot take, because they are fully capable culturally to say, I may not win this war, but my kid's going to win it. You know, I may die tomorrow. I may die of old age, but I'm not going to stop fighting. My kid's going to pick up the rifle and keep fighting. And I think, you know, that's such a good metaphor for the hot takeism that's going on now, where everybody's pointing and blaming, and it's this guy and it's that guy and winning political points. And at the end of the day, in my humble opinion, whose fault? It's everybody's fault. It's literally Americans' fault. It's Bush's fault. It's Obama's fault. It's Trump's fault. It's Biden's fault. It's the Afghans' fault. Like, nobody is innocent. No one's hands are clean. History has taught us, and again, I'm going to throw a lot of dumb quotes at you, but Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. That's not just like a slogan. When I first landed in Afghanistan and was deployed to the eastern side of the country, where I spent my time in Ghazni province, Paktika province, and a little time in Gardez province, literally the first day we're on this Afghan army base, and the group, the Americans who were there that we were replacing, there's like, we call this thing a right seat, left seat. So for like 2 or 3 days, you're going out on, you're basically shadowing the person who's leaving, who's got a year of institutional knowledge and wisdom. And you get to try to be a sponge for 2 or 3 days and get as much knowledge, like watch around this corner here. They love to put IEDs here. This guy makes great freaking mango slushies, you know, like literally everything down to where to get something that you can eat that will make you throw up. Like, that's what's going on in these 3 days. And I remember this guy pointing up, like, Afghanistan on the eastern side is mountains, whole lot of mountains, whole lot of hills. There's nothing really flat to speak of. And he points up on this hill that we could see from the base, you know, maybe a mile away. I don't know, something like that. And on it is the most unimpressive mud walls in a complete state of decay, deterioration. But you can see that there, it used to be like a square fortification of some sort. I don't know what exactly the purpose was, but it looked like crap. I mean, it just was dirt. It was mud walls, and they're just eroding and eroding. And he's like, Alexander the Great's army built those. And you're like, wait, and I'm going to tell you my ignorance right now. Is that 1,000 years ago? Is that 2,000? Like, I don't know. I just know it's a long time ago. And I'm like, wow, holy crap, Alexander the Great. Yeah. And I'm like, why don't people like mess around with that? Like, just think of America. This is a bad analogy. American context. Every high school kid would be up there drinking beers and punching holes in the dirt and scraping their name in it and everything. Well, Afghans don't drink beers for the most part. But I'm like, why isn't it being messed with? And he's like, oh, because the Russians use that. And there's like 10,000 mines. If you go up the hill, like,
you're done, right?
Walking. Like, you're not going to make it back down. So then Gardez, that's the FOB, the forward operating base. I was only there for a couple days. And then I got moved to my final, like, forward deployment, which was Ghazni. And Ghazni, the FOB, the forward operating base, sorry if I slip into some army, I'll try to translate to human.
That's right.
I go on this base, and it's literally, you've seen Road Warrior. I know we watched that together back in the day.
Yes, indeed.
It is literally apocalypse, and it's all abandoned Russian equipment. Like, the creepiest, coolest things. There's this giant satellite, for lack of a better term, satellite truck. And the truck had been gutted. I mean, it was just like the frame of the truck. But on the top was a huge metal satellite dish. And the wind just blew it, and it would just feel like creaking all day and all night. Like a ghost, like literally a ghost of the Russian war and occupation. And a pack of feral dogs had made that their home. Like, they lived in the truck. So you didn't go near the truck unless you had a gun, because they would attack and you'd have to shoot dogs. And, you know, you don't want to go down that route. But this whole base was just debris from the Russians, rusted out. And now I look back and I'm like, what a cocky, like, something really bad about Americans. We're really cocky. We're really like, we can do it, which is a good thing. But it's also a bad thing because it sets you up for failure. I literally remember sitting there with my friends, American fellow soldiers, and we're laughing and we're like, Russians couldn't handle this. Like, they suck. Look, they had to leave with their tail behind their ass and they left all their equipment. And now I'm seeing just hundreds of Humvees just sitting there. I'm like, oh my God, it's even worse, like 10 times worse, right? It's 10 times worse. But anyways, I guess the point I'm getting at is you have this hubris of Americans and our just idea of we can go anywhere and solve any problem with military might, which traditionally works in traditional wars. If the Taliban had lined up with tanks and pointed their tanks at ours, we would have won the war in 2 days. But they didn't, because they're smart. And we're too stubborn to recognize that sometimes fighting dirty and low tech and low skill will win if you have 20 years or 40 years or 60 years where you're willing to fight it. So the Taliban set us up for failure, but also, you know, like, and kudos to them. They were committed to the cause. We talked about this before. To me, the Taliban are modern day fascists. And the reason why I was like, I want to go to Afghanistan, because I was like, wow, Uncle Sam's kind of on the right side on this one. Cause I've had, you know, we've had a lot of problems with some of our military engagements with other countries. And I think you and I would agree. Why are we supporting these guys? These guys are tyrants. These guys are death squads. Like, isn't it clear we should be supporting the people? Whatever. We don't need to go into that. But, you know, Afghanistan was a case of, in my opinion, where we actually were going after the bad guys, the Al-Qaedas of the world, these mullahs who were throwing acid on women's faces and whatnot. And I wanted to be, like you mentioned in the intro, I had been to Afghanistan first as a civilian, working with a group that was building schools for women and girls. And they're building schools for women because there were generations of women who'd never been able to go to school. So you literally had 40-year-old women in like a second grade classroom. And I remember meeting this one woman who, and I mentioned acid, she had burns on her face. And she was like my hero. She was like, can I swear? Is it okay?
Yes, yes. No FCC regulations here,
baby.
There
we go. Well, I just don't want to bring your standards down any more than I already
No,
have.
Believe me.
She was like, she was just so brave. She's like, I'm not going to cover. I refuse to cover. She's like, any man who wants to say anything, I will fight them. You know, knowing that, like, it was a death sentence, but she wasn't going to bow down. And I was like, man, if those are the kind of people that are being groomed for leadership in this country, like, I'm for this. Even though if you've spent any time in Afghanistan, you'd be like, oh, my God, there's so much stuff here that's so repressive. the homophobia, the sexism. I mean, it's just like it makes your head hurt, the degrees of abuse that large chunks of the population go through. But they were still better than the alternative.
Right.
Even though the government in Afghanistan was very patriarchal, whatever, they at least were willing to let women have roles. They were at least willing to open a door and let women push through and keep pushing. So for me, it was, you know, at the time, in my mind, it was a good fight. In hindsight, maybe I reflect a little more on it. It was probably more a gray area. But the moral of the story is just today, the hot take, who's at fault? Everybody's at fault. Everybody's at fault. Afghanistan, for all their beautiful things they have about their culture, they also have an incredible ability to horse trade, to not be loyal to like a cause, so to speak. They'll switch sides like you could flip a card. And the level of corruption, I've never seen anything like it in my life. Where we were, you know, when Biden said there's the military's 300 men and women strong. I think he just said 300 men strong, but there are women in the military too there. I like chuckled because I remember what it was like. I was embedded with an Afghan army unit, a battalion, or as they call it, a Kandak. Mm-hmm. And on paper, my rifle company that I was supposed to mentor was like, I forget, 200 people. I never counted more than 80 people once, like boots on the ground in the barracks. Like people just left. And not only did they leave, Kevin, they'd come back and be like, I don't know where my rifle and my helmet and my body armor are. I have no idea what happened to it. And Afghans are so used to like that type of corruption. They don't even try. They don't even bother to give you a story. They're just like, it's gone. Because everybody knows, like, of course you sold your rifle to some dude. Because
I had it, I left, and now it's gone.
Dude, yeah, I was like, for lack of, there are no front lines in Afghanistan because everything was a front line. But there were areas where combat was regular and expected. And I was in one of those areas, unfortunately. And there were parts of the country where combat was rare and unexpected. And maybe there'd be an occasional car bomb. Like Kabul was like, there were Taliban running around shooting every day, but you never knew when a suicide bomber could pop off or something like that. And so the main training bases where they pump out these 300,000 soldiers in the Afghan army, you'd be lucky if only 25% just went right to Chicken Street, which was, ironically enough, your podcast, which was where like the bazaar, like you bought and sold everything. And they literally, with all their equipment, just be like, how much? And then they'd go back to the army base and be like, I don't know where it is. I need more. And it was just like, it made your head hurt, the level of corruption. But you know what? In the defense of the Afghans, when you're poor and all of a sudden there's a sugar daddy, Uncle Sam, who's just literally like, the money is never ends. I might have done the same thing too.
Yeah, this is one of the things I was, you know, talking to Sean, who's like my co-host on our Friday show. And, you know, I was saying one of the things that was so striking to me was the kind of infrastructure that built up around, to use your word, the sugar daddy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because you're talking about like literally towns that are 100% dependent upon the flow of money and goods in and out of these areas around bases and so on. And, you know, I was brought back. I mean, I think you remember like Cynthia Enloe's book, Banana Beaches and Bases, from like way back in the day. Mm-hmm. Is like she was like, you know, would talk about these kind of these infrastructures that would get set up around there. And there was these, you know, stories that were coming out as, you know, this is before, you know, the past 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, so, you know, people saying, look, we've got all these goods, we've got all this stuff they're going to sell, but now we have to say what's going to happen next. And a lot of the folks they interview is like, well, you know, we're just going to go. Right. So there's going to be this big infrastructure that is going to be just completely left behind. Right. And then there's a big question mark at that point. What happens to all those people's, because you're talking 20 years, right? 20 years, like a whole generation being dependent upon this quote unquote town. Yeah. Right. So you got that on the one side. And on the other side, we talked a little about this before, is like, you know, you talked about the education of women and girls. Right. Yeah. And now you've actually got some of the best journalism that I have seen coming out of Afghanistan, like by these women journalists that's getting picked up by The Guardian and this other stuff that they've been kind of working with them. And now they're running for their lives, right? So you've got, I mean, this is the aftermath. And I keep on, what I can't help get away from in the midst of all this is saying, you know, who pays for that? You know, and again, and I don't think there's an easy answer to that, which is exactly the problem we're talking about, you know, the after empire.
Here, I'll tell you what, who pays for that? Well, for the last 20 years, the American taxpayer
paid for it.
And to a smaller extent, European taxpayers paid for it. And now what's going to happen now is who's going to pay for it? The Taliban has no money. This country, like right now, there's kind of this, I would argue, really false kind of sense of a fait accompli. Taliban has no money. You have tens of thousands of people, some of which you described, who were just like people who sold crafts or sodas or waters outside of the bases, right? Because there were a ton of contractors. I mean, my little Afghan base had dozens of Afghans who came and worked on it. They cooked food for the Afghan soldiers. They did maintenance. They cleaned stuff, you know, yada, yada, yada. Their jobs are gone. Like, literally, you have a economy that is right now is, like, it's literally evaporating. Where are the jobs? Okay, so let's fast forward 6 months from now when all these people who had barely any income before, it's all gone. The Taliban is not equipped to govern in any kind of sense. Like, they're equipped to govern to enforce religious doctrine and enforce loyalty to said religious doctrine. They're not equipped in any manner to dig wells, fill potholes. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So while there's a sense like, oh my God, the Taliban's taken over, I wouldn't be surprised in 6-8 months if there's just mass unrest across the whole country because the Taliban's gone from a guerrilla army to now being expected to govern, and they're not going to be able to do that. It could all fall apart again, and then you could have different movements and ethnic groups being like, we're in charge of this section. And then we're back to basically, you know, 1999, 1998, where you had warring factions controlling different parts of the country. And, you know, to use a technical term, a shit show.
Yeah.
A shit show.
Exactly. Exactly. And I was, you know, I saw some of the reporting too, is to talk about some of these warlords, right? From back again, before American involvement, these warlords, and like some people were starting to turn to them, right? And then they're realizing like, these guys are like fat and old with rusty stuff around them now. They're just like all on reputation. They don't have anything. They've got no like fighting force. So you're talking about like an unforeseeable future.
Yeah.
Right. Where these, you know, these players are now going to be cast out. So, all right. So what you look at what, again, we talked a little bit about this before the show too, but one of the things that got me wanting to shut off the media too, as well as had to do with, you know, nobody really seemed to have a good take, a good analysis of what happened. The fact that the Taliban ran through like over the course of like, you know, 10, 11 days.
Right.
And everybody wanted to have a good one, but everyone felt like really like these people are just talking out their asses. Right.
Yeah.
They're keeping themselves in like employed for the moment.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, did you see that coming right from where you sit?
My friend. I'm going to tell you a vignette that will just explain all of this. Again, I mentioned I was in Ghazni. Ghazni is a part of I didn't know any of this, by the way, when I was there. I learned it after the fact or learned it under as I went along. But Ghazni is on the eastern side of the country, and it's a part of the country. You know, I compare it to the deep south in the sense that there's just this like innate genetic, it's not really genetic, but I'm using that term loosely, like a suspicion and rejection of centralized government, right? The people of Ghazni are just like, they don't want to hear anybody from Kabul say anything because they're like, F Kabul. And then the people in the outskirt districts, from the city Ghazni, the district, you know, provincial leaders, whatever, the people in this countryside are like, F them. Like, there's just this culture of, we don't want you to bother us. Like, libertarianism times Islam equals like Ghazni. Like, just don't F with us. Don't tell us what to do. Don't try to give us rules, because we don't want to follow anything. And it doesn't matter who's in power. There's that tendency to be against that, right? So first off, Ghazni, you have that going against you when you're there trying to help build the Afghan government and trust in the Afghan government, etc. But the telling story, the vignette I want to tell you, is that before the United States intervened and before that phase of civil war in the 90s, you had the Russians there, right? And the Russians had a civil war. And you were either on the side of the Afghan government or the Mujahideen. And as with all civil wars eventually end. And sometimes those groups overlap. Sometimes friendships are rekindled. Sometimes, again, people trade sides. So here I am in Ghazni on an Afghan army base with the 2/1/203 Corps Kandak. And our job is to go out every day on missions and try to find and engage with the enemy. In this case, it's Taliban and Al-Qaeda. There were some Al-Qaeda operatives in the rural areas there. And every day you're going out and risking your ass getting blown up. And every day the Taliban soldiers are going out risking their ass and getting blown up. And come to find out, after being there for a while and after getting to really start talking like nitty gritty with my interpreters, who are Afghan, who speak obviously Dari and English, it turns out that the commander of the Afghan unit that I'm working for, the battalion commander, was best buddies during the Russian war with the commander of the Taliban in that area, right? Like, they were friends in the 70s. They were on the same team. I forget. I think they were both with the Russian side. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. These guys were literally best friends back in the day, and they were still in regular contact. So much so that for months I often wondered, why is it that there was an American base about a mile down the road from our little abandoned Russian shithole that we lived on, which was the Afghan base. They would always get rockets and mortars, like, at night. They were just always getting blown up at night, and we never once did. Not once. For months, and I was like, that's kind of weird. You know, whatever, that's kind of weird. Okay, whatever. Well, it turns out that the Afghan battalion commander, who I worked for and with, and the Taliban regional commander, they made a deal. No night fighting. We take the nights off. We're not going to fuck with you. Don't you guys come out and fuck with us. Like, no Americans knew that. We found that out kind of by accident. And after that fact, we're like, wait, so we can sleep at night and not be like security and pulling, you know, the Afghans still pulled security on the outer perimeter, but we had a little whatever compound within it that we did, and we're like, they're like, nope, you're good. Nighttime, it's like, time out. I was like, this time is crazy. Now, fast forward to 2 weeks ago, where the Taliban just took over Ghazni. Not a shot was fired. Why do you think that was? Because for years prior, there had been these previous relationships. And like I said, Afghans, to their credit or to their detriment, when they feel like the war's going one way, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, we're on this team now. You know, the classic bandwagon fans. Think of all the Patriot fans out there who've never even been to New England and love Tom Brady and the Patriots. Why? Because they're always winning, and they want to be with the winner. You know, like, that. I think there's a human natural thing that drives us towards that. But either way, the Taliban took over Ghazni, took over the army bases, took over the bases I worked at, without a shot being fired, because of those previous relationships and negotiations that had happened that we as Americans either were blind to or disregarded. Because to be fair to us, like, it's not like we were so stupid and clueless, but the Afghans who you work with will tell you to your face, oh my God, we'd never surrender to Taliban. Hey, Taliban, tomorrow, 12 o'clock, we're going to surrender. Like, that's just the way it is. You know, it's not putting down Afghans. I'm sure if we were in the same boat, we'd probably react in a similar way. But, you know, the 11 days, the takeover, it was 5% force, it was 10% show of force, and I'm going to guess whatever my math is, 85% negotiated behind the scenes. Hey, we're all Afghans. We know you're going to win, so we're not going to fight it. Just, this is a deal. We surrender, but you don't come and kill us, and you don't hunt us down, and we just, like, pretend like, what war? You know, what war? I don't know what you're talking about. We're all Afghans now. So I think that's kind of how the whole thing played out. If Ghazni's a microcosm of the rest of the country, I could see that happening in the rest of the country too, because there's nothing unique about – there's nothing – you could pick Taliban, and half of them were with the Russians, and half of them were with the Mujahideen. And the same thing with the Afghan National Security Forces. Half of them fought on the Team Russia, and half of them fought with the Mujahideen. And it's just like, well, this one seems like they're the Patriots. Go Tom Brady. I'm on this team now. You know, like, that's how it plays out.
Well, that's certainly the way that it looked, too. Even some of the reporting, like, kind of caught up after a while, saying, like, oh, it seems that there were these deals that nobody knew about that were happening. And then literally kind of walked into Kabul being like, you know, okay, we're here now. Like, everyone else back there, they just kind of welcomed us. We kind of went through, no problem. We could do that here too, or we could do it the hard way. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, okay, where's that air base again? So. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, it's whatever.
Well, so let me ask you. Well, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
One thing that is. True is that we are very culturally illiterate. We were when we went into Afghanistan. I remember in our 3 months of training beforehand, I was literally ridiculed, like, to the point where it was just like I was the nerd who pooped in his pants on the first day of kindergarten and no one wanted to talk to me, where I was like, where are the language classes? Where are the culture classes? It was so bad. Me, white kid, who, granted, I do speak Spanish, but they don't speak Spanish in Afghanistan. I organized language and culture classes for my team of 16 soldiers because I was like, we need to know this shit. And we need to know some words like enemy, left, right, fought. Like, literally, I created the worst Dari class you could ever. No college credits. And everybody made fun of me for it. And I was just like, guys. Because I'm a student of, like, irregular warfare, like, you know, the Sandinistas and FMO. Like, this is how you win these things. If you go in there, America, you're fucked. Like,
you're done.
Game over. And so anyways, we're very culturally illiterate. And I think knowing, like, the high-ranking military people that I know, they're very, like, A, B, C, D, statistic equals victory, da-da-da-da. And I think they believe that. You know, I really do. I don't think the American military was, like, lying to everybody. I think they really believed, oh, no, if we just have more soldiers and more bombs, we'll win. And it's just not how it works. But I interrupted you.
No. It's like, no, that's it's a perfect, right? I mean, you got to be able to kind of, you know what's going on. And, well, I don't know. I don't want to get off on a sidetrack here. I'm trying to prevent myself from just going into a rant, but I'm not going to do it, right? Because this is what – so let's go to, like, where, like, this evacuation stuff that's going on now. I found out last night, like, you know, again, I'm up. My semester starts in a week from tonight, uh-huh. A week from today. And so I'm, like, doing all this late night prep and all this stuff. And my brother just kind of texts me, like, of course, cause he's all god awful night. It's like 1:30 in the morning. And he's like, oh yeah, you got any advice for doing interviews? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, the news is gonna be interviewed. I'm like, what the hell is this guy talking about? And it turns out he got involved with this digital Dunkirk thing. Yeah, Have you heard about this? Yeah. And so he got involved with this, and he starts sending me all these videos and things like this about kind of helping get people out and get families out and all this stuff. Right. And I'm thinking, like, well, number one is, like, there's this kind of huge uptick in this concern, right, about making sure that we get people out. There's, like, on the one hand, that people are paying attention to, like, people in Afghanistan for the first time, which was right. That was interesting.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, it's like, you know, it does seem, like you mentioned before, you know, this is Biden. Biden is going to own this, right? Yeah. And this is, I mean, whatever you want to say. What should be, what shouldn't be, as a practical matter, that's kind of where we're at this point. And, you know, I started thinking about if the announcement was made that we're going to get out of here by then, it's like, it would have seemed that there would have been a much longer kind of, like, lead up to this or something. But then I'm like, I don't know. You know, I mean, you know, I'm as much, having to deal with the filter of the U.S. media as anybody else about what was actually happening. And, you know, I saw some good reporting coming out of like The Guardian and BBC and stuff. They were saying, no, actually, look, there was a lot of kind of behind the scenes stuff that was kind of happening ahead of time. But still, you look at these images now and it feels like, holy crap, this is just like chaos.
Right. No. I got a lot of opinions on this. First off is there is a group called No One Left Behind, which I worked with before, but I'm not active with anymore. And my friend Matt Zeller, who is on all the MSNBC and CNN and Fox stuff nowadays, because he basically is running that organization. He's also an SU graduate. And he also, I met him because I was talking about Afghanistan at SU when he was a student. He joined the CIA, then he went on to be in the military, and he did the same job I did. He was deployed and embedded with the Afghan National Army. And he and I both have the same kick-ass awesome interpreter, or Taji man, as you would say in Afghanistan. And if anybody's interested in supporting that work or supporting the families and stuff, just Google No One Left Behind or Matt with two T's, Zeller, Z-E-L-L-E-R. He's a good guy. And he's got great progressive politics too. He's an example of someone who has walked on both paths and can see the pros and cons of stuff, but he's got good politics. Anyways, good news is most of my interpreters got the special SIV, special immigration visa.
Immigration visa category.
That Matt lobbied for. Like, he was part of the whole process of getting this law passed and meeting with all the bigwigs on Capitol Hill and doing this. And first problem is that this visa program is great. And like I said, most of the interpreters I work with have been in the United States for years now, because they got the visa. Then we have this little thing happen, this little unfortunate event called the Trump administration, where freaking Stephen Miller shut this thing down. Why? Because he didn't want brown Arab Muslim people, not Arabs, Afghans are not Arabs, I'm sorry, brown Persian Muslim people coming to the United States. So right there, you have this huge backlog of years of people. So already the system is dysfunctional and broke, and to say it was constipated would be an understatement. Mm-hmm. Biden comes on and inherits this extreme constipation. Then he inherits the collapse of the military and the government, which, again, I don't think anybody saw coming. And like you said, and what I said, in the military, you're taught, if you're the commander, you are responsible for everything you achieve, and you are guilty of everything you fail to do. And it's Biden's, he's the commander now, it's his shit show he's got to fix. And I would argue that they made some mistakes, but this is arguing from hindsight. You know, when he was on TV a few weeks ago saying, it's not Saigon, it's not going to fall, it's not going to collapse, all their systems were anticipating that to be a reality, that you didn't need to airlift 9,000 people out every day, that you could just slow roll it and get out your interpreters and get out these other, you know, high value targets to the Taliban in an orderly fashion. So I'm not critical of Biden in that regard. I think he was operating from a logical position, which I agree with and felt was an accurate one. And I'm a guy who spent a year there on the ground seeing these relationships happen and see all this crazy, wonky, you know, Afghan voodoo stuff going on with their horse trading and whatnot politically. But I never thought this would happen either. So, but it's his problem now. His problem. He made, in hindsight, he had a good plan, and the plan went to hell, as they say, once that, because the enemy gets a vote. And the enemy voted and the enemy won, and now the enemy is, at least in some aspect, in some semblance, in charge of Afghanistan. So.
No, I totally. I mean, look, it's always struck me as like, what this is like one of the most disingenuous things that I've seen when I was talking about, you know, these hot takes that was going on, was basically pointing to, Trump did this. I'm like, that is so irrelevant as a question right now. I mean, that's a matter for like history years from now to be able to figure out what exactly happened. But you're talking about in the present, right, that by pointing to Trump, it does zero. Right at this point. So let me ask you, I got a, we got a question on YouTube here. It's from my friend, actually, Mike, who's also a vet. He's a veteran from Iraq. He says, like, how much did your higher headquarters know about what you saw on the ground?
It's a classic. Oh, okay. So we, the great thing about the job we had, and you said his name's Mike?
Mike Embo.
Yes, Mike. In Iraq, I think they were called MIT teams, MTT. In Afghanistan, they're called ETT, Embedded Training Teams. Basically a similar mission. But the beauty of being an ETT was we were, what we like to say, far away from the flagpole. There was no adult supervision. Like, you could grow a beard. You could wear a baseball cap. I mean, you could basically roll like you were special operations, even though we weren't. I shouldn't say we weren't. None of us were qualified or trained in special forces type schools or anything like that. But the mission we were doing was essentially a special forces mission. But we were not special forces. But anyways, we were away from the flagpole. So for the most part, big army ignored us and thought we were away, we were in their way. And we were, for lack of a better term, like, we were not helping. And then that sounds kind of contradictory. Like, what do you mean you're not helping? You're working to build the Afghan army. Because the Afghan army was rookie. It was not professional. So when an Afghan and American combined mission happened, the Afghans showed up late. We showed up missing equipment. We showed up in the wrong place. Whereas Uncle Sam was like, at this time, at this place, we're there. And there was very little patience among regular army units for Afghan forces. And by the way, there was a lot of mistrust. And again, it's understandable. When I show up at an Afghan army base and it's me and a handful of other Americans and it's hundreds of Afghans, like, the first few days was like, holy shit, like, watch your back, you know? But in my case, and I can only speak for my Kandak I work with, these guys were loyal as the day is long. They had my back. I never once had to worry about them. I never once had to be like, oh, are they going to freaking shank me? Which started happening years after I was there. They call it green on blue, where Afghans started getting pressure from the Taliban and being like, we'll give you $5,000 if you kill an American, or we'll give it to your family or whatever, you know? So that did become an issue. But when I was there in 2006 and 2007, my Kandak was awesome, and I never had to worry about that. But American soldiers, you know, all pumped up on rock and roll and Mountain Dew, see these Afghan soldiers and are just like, we don't trust these motherfuckers. And, you know, point gun. I'm like, dude, this is our team. Like, what the fuck are you doing? This is team, same team. Don't be acting like these are the bad guys unless you really want them to be the bad guys. And then they will become the bad guys. And my ass will be the first one getting, you know, shot up. But anyways, because of that kind of tension, and because big army did not have either a respect for the Afghan security forces or a direct involvement, Task Force Phoenix was just this one brigade. I mean, it was literally one brigade off to the side, and we had very little interaction. And usually it was awesome, because when we did, we'd just be like, literally, this is one of these like Napoleon Dynamite, like, the nerds win, vote for Pedro wins, you know, where you're sitting there in this dusty field and it's like the Afghan forces there and the Americans forces are there and we're going to attack, you know, whatever. And the Americans are like, you tell those Afghans that this is what they're going to do. And I'd be like, no, they don't follow your orders. We're going to do what we want to do. And this is out, you know, I'm not Afghan, but I was team Afghanistan, right? I'd be like, no, this is what we're going to do. And you're going to have to work around this. So it was a really like Twilight Zone experience where you actually could go tell big army to fuck off. That didn't mean they would, but it was not like there was no, they didn't mess around with us. They just didn't really understand us. They were kind of scared of us and they'd leave us alone for the most part. That's a long
time. Mike says it sounds about right. So he worked with Kurds and experienced about the same. So,
yeah.
I got another question for you too, as well, if you're willing to take it. This is from Paul, is basically saying, look, it's a bit off topic, what we were talking about this stuff, but, Do you think that would be a way of using like humanitarian reparations as a way to stabilize Afghanistan? So you've heard some good arguments for reparations instead of the type of nation building that the U.S. ended up doing along. He says, but I don't know anything about the situation. So he's trying to get a gauge on it.
You know what? I'm not sure exactly what he means by reparations, but I have thought this in the last week, and maybe this dovetails with that question. Like, what carrots and sticks does the world have now with the Taliban? And the number one is money, because all the money that's been keeping the Afghan economy afloat for the last 20 years is done. It's gone. So maybe in the sense of, you could call, I don't know if you want to call it reparations or humanitarian aid or whatever, but that may be where we have more leverage than we ever had to say, hey, you don't want your people to starve. We don't want your people to starve. How about, like, you allow girls to keep going to schools and we'll pay for teachers, you know, things like that. As far as reparations, like, I only really know, like, the American context. I know we paid reparations every day in Afghanistan, because every time we blew up a compound and killed some kids or shot up someone's cow, like, I don't want to go too deep into the weeds, but every month I had a bag of $20,000, like, in Afghan currency. Like, literally every ETT team would go to Kabul every month and get a garbage bag full of cash, and it was meant to smooth over these kind of problems and stuff. So we've been paying reparations from day one, and if anything, you know, we're horrible that we're killing civilians and being careless with our application of kinetic force. But at the same time, the military was really good at being like, we did this. It may not seem like that here, but we did this, and here's a ton of money, and we're sorry. You know, whether the really felt sorrow or not is irrelevant. We paid tons of reparations for all sorts of dumb things. It got so bad that Afghans would shoot their own cow and be like, I'm not even kidding.
I don't mean to laugh. That's just like, I didn't see that one coming.
No, sorry. You would, like, they just take the old diseased sheep and plug it full of AK-47 holes and be like, stray fire from Americans, and bring it to the base. And the base doesn't know. They're like, well, we don't want this person to join the Taliban. So here's, you know, $500 for your goat that you shot that was on its last leg anyway. So again, they're great at playing this game.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say about the money being this possibility, because it seems like right now, and this is kind of like another avenue that we didn't really talk ahead about, but with it seems to be the game that China seems to want to play right about now, because they're staying at least for now.
Yeah.
Right. And they're in there saying, hey, look, just don't wreck our stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And we're going to stay.
Yep.
Right. We're going to keep things going. Don't mess this stuff up. Right. And then we'll step forward here. Right. Of course, it's a very similar dynamic which they have in Africa, too, as well. What you're saying.
They're called belt and what? What's their big belt? And there's a name for their strategy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something.
Something road. Belt road.
Belt road. Maybe that's what it is.
Something like this. Yeah, yeah.
No, the Chinese are eating our lunch. And while they also, I feel, have a pretty totalitarian system that I would not want to live under.
Exactly.
Kudos to them for recognizing we're no longer in the age of tanks and fighter airplanes. Like, you build things and you make deals and you make friends. And even if it's a dirty deal and you're buying out people or whatever, bribing them, it costs China a hell of a lot less. And last time I checked, the number of Chinese soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan is about 2,100 less than how many Americans died. It's zero. You know?
Yeah.
And when all said and done, you know, like, there's this big picture thing of what a folly and what a screw up, but there's also dudes who I know who are dead, you know, Afghan soldiers, American soldiers, Taliban soldiers who I never talked to, but I shot. And, like, I'm sure if there was an opportunity to have everybody sit around by a campfire, we would realize we had so much more in common than we didn't. And that's, you know, war, that's the ultimate tragedy. Young people died, and it's just,
yeah, absolutely. 100%. Well, listen, we're running up kind of at the end of the show. I do want to, we'll go to a quick break, and then We'll say kind of like adieu to Ben in kind of like in a bit, but who knows, you know, he might stay on afterwards, but I'll have some closing comments about some upcoming show notes and things like this. And if anybody does that calls, they want to call in, you can hop on. The information is in the kind of the YouTube channel, I believe, about how to log in. Let me just kind of throw that link up there. I'll throw that up there in a second. But so Ben, you know, just, I guess I got two things to ask you as we're kind of closing out. It's like number one, like what would you kind of leave people with, right? Just in terms of way of understanding kind of where we're at now as kind of closing thoughts. And look, I've seen this tremendous kind of outpouring too as well of people looking what to do. Mm-hmm. Right. And if you had to give people advice, because I know I'm going to get these questions too as well. So you recommend, like, where do you put your money? Right. If you're going to really want to kind of help out some things that are kind of on the ground with some organizations, where would you put your money? So closing thoughts and kind of what could people do at this point?
Okay. Are you on now or after?
Yeah. No. Yeah, that's good. Sorry.
I mentioned it before. No One Left Behind. It's a organization run by a really good progressive guy. It was the first and maybe until 2 weeks ago, really the only group that was helping Afghan interpreters and their immediate families immigrate to the United States. I can speak for every Afghan interpreter I met with. Unfortunately, they're here instead of there. And I think if they were there, they would have a better role in shaping the future of their country. But these are like good people. They're people who are open to learning other cultures. They're not, you know, when you think of some kind of caricatures of Afghans or people from that part of the world, they're very like, you know, ideological. Like, these are just good people who want to do good in the world. And they happen to be born in a country that's in a civil war. And I think that the more interpreters and their families who can be put in a safe place, the better off we all are as human beings, because these are the people who literally fought and died, and I had interpreters get killed in combat, who wanted to build a multicultural, multi-ethnic, democratic, inclusive government that women had roles and weren't just treated as chattel. So No One Left Behind would be the group I would tell people to check out. And, you know, you can donate, you can volunteer. Yep. A lot of stuff they do is literally like helping families move into apartments. Like, literally they go to what's the place you buy cheap furniture, Rescue Mission. They buy a bunch of couches and they haul them over to an apartment and be like, now you have somewhere to sit. You know, it's like literally simple things like that. You can get your hands dirty. You can donate money or however you want to get involved. So that to me would really be, since we're talking about Afghanistan, we're talking about what's next. What's next is we don't want these people to be executed because they supported, you know, a dream of a democratic, inclusive Afghanistan. Maybe it was a fool's dream, but still they were on the right team. In my humble opinion, they were on the right team.
All right. Absolutely. Well, man, hey, listen, I can't thank you enough for, you know, taking some time out of your good cigars and IPA. I still remember, I got to tell this story, as the one of the nights that I remember most was in Planet Ludlow in New York.
Yes.
Where Ben had decided to bring in a bunch of Cuban cigars. You just got back from Cuba. You had, so when I say Cuban cigars, I don't mean like, you know, somebody, no, he's like fresh as fresh can be. They had to be, I have to say, some of the best cigars I've ever had in my life at that particular point. And we got kicked out of the bar because the cigar smoke was too deep. So
that's the worst thing that happens to us, so be it. Fight the power. Yeah. Fight the power.
I hear you, man. Well, hey, Ben, thank you so much. Listen, we're going to put kind of links in the show notes to No One Left Behind, kind of link directly there. So if you want to donate, you're looking for some kind of directed way, you make sure you're not going to get scammed or somebody's grift, somebody's actually doing good work, is a good place to kind of give it there. We'll also put links to some, I'm going to put some of those links to some of Ben's, say, commentary into his book that, you know, the book is, I mean, God, I was thinking, it's like 10 years old now, right?
Yeah. It's a long war, Kevin. It's been a long war.
Yeah, no shit. I mean, that's what I was kind of like thinking about this is, you know, his book, which I mentioned at the top of there, is, you know, Greetings from Afghanistan, Send More Ammo, is an absolute fabulous read, as are all the archived dispatches that he gave. We've got NPR National throughout the time, which I still have these moments, Ben, where I, you know, I remember kind of listening to them, and it'll be like at nighttime and it's in the dark, and I'm hearing your voice coming over here talking about what's going on the ground. And so I'll put some links to that too as well.
Thank you.
Yes. As always, brother, man, I appreciate the time. And I think that sometime soon we're going to have another one, a meetup of the old crew on kind of our good Zoom.
I'll get the cigars.
Indeed. All right, man. Well, thank you so much. So listen, we're going to take a quick break. If anybody wants to kind of stick around for some closing thoughts, or you got some additional questions or thoughts that may or may not be related to what we have tonight, please do. But Ben, thanks so much, man. Good talking. We'll talk to you soon.
Peace.
All right, take it easy. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be right back after this quick break. If it's going to actually play my music, which it doesn't seem like it wants to do right now. Let's try that again. Here we go. There it is. All right, good. So they're on break. We're not broadcasting now. So,
okay.
But hey, man, thanks so much, man. I really, really appreciate it. Yeah. And it doesn't look like we got calls coming in. So, I mean, you're welcome to hang out for the closing thoughts you want, but you know.
Yeah. I'll just keep the tab open. I can do some emails and stuff, and then I'll go make some dinner and have an IPA. You know me.
There you go, man. I'm going to do that. That's how I'm going to tap off my night too. So here we go. All right. I'll do some,
all right, I'll shut up.
All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken once again. Thank you all for kind of tuning out. We had some, great turnout on YouTube tonight. It was fantastic. And I know there's been a lot of people who said, hey, listen, I can't make the show tonight. But is it going to be up? Lots of questions coming in. And absolutely, it'll be up live. You know, as soon as we're done with this, the show will be live on YouTube. And the podcast will be posted in about an hour. So if you're listening live, you can pass that on to folks too as well. One of the things that I find most difficult at times, especially doing this kind of work, right, from the left, kind of progressive, and try to actually not simply just get on a side for this side, but actually trying to deal with some of the nuance of like a conflict like what we see in Afghanistan. Right. I mean, it's very easy to get on, you know, another version of what Ben said about, you know, the Tom Brady, the Patriots folks, right? Just to get on one bag, when I can get on a team and play a team and then kind of, you know, shut yourself off to everything else. And then whatever that team says and so on. And I want to give you a different, and this is a totally different example from different context, right? As you all know, if you've been listening to this show, we've got, nut jobs showing up at our school boards now. Right. I mean, right in my school board, in my school district, you've got the kind of like critical race theory nut jobs showing up. And now we find out that you've got these kind of like patriot militia groups that are going to be showing up at Central Bucks school district, which is right down the road for me. Right. And it's all over masking. Right. You know, it's all over like, you know, should we have masks or freedom and blah, blah, blah. And one of the most difficult things about that kind of conversation about whether masks are going to be useful in a school context, right, is it really requires that we're paying attention to specifics and try to make rational, good decisions that are going to be best for our kids. And, you know, yes, I have a direct stake in this, right? My daughter's too young right now to get the shot, right? My son, you know, he's 12 going on 13. He's already had the vaccine, right, which is great. But she's not. And all elementary kids have not been able to get the vaccine at this point. So we're sitting there kind of trying to figure out how to, you know, recognize our kids want to be in school, want to be with their friends, and they're having to look at the science. And instead, it's this kind of like factless debate, which easily devolves into like you pick your side, right? And really, you know, some of the hard work that we have to do at some point along the line, right, is to listen and try to kind of understand the complexities of the different kind of context. And, you know, like the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, whatever we're going to talk about, right? There's top level stuff, which we could talk about. We're reading about American empire, right? And looking at what's the American imperialism and kind of in the broad scope of history, right? That is a really important discussion, right? And there's kind of all sorts of disagreements about what the kind of US role is in at that level, right? That's one discussion. And I would say in some ways that's an academic discussion, right? That we and an important one, right? But one we have to understand. But when we're kind of, we get down to the ground of things, when we're in the moment, right? Now we have to figure out kind of like how we understand and how we actually think and relate to other people that are kind of involved in this. And, you know, one of the reasons that it was, you know, so important for me, at least, to want to have Ben on the show, we get to have that kind of conversation, right? We get to have the conversation of, you know, someone who's not, you know, she's not showing up as an ideologue, right? You know, coming here or some like you said, you know, America, 100%, right? Because chances are that's not the way the world is. Right. And I think it benefits all of us to say, look, if we're going to have a pathway forward from the left, right, that, you know, part of our job is thinking about expanding, right, our power base, right, and not getting into the kind of factionalism that the left is so known for, right? And we've talked about this in the show over the years and so on, but that's really important. And, you know, my closing thoughts on that and kind of the Afghanistan stuff, this is one of the things that I said, I think back on Friday too, is like, if one thing that we have to reckon with, I think as Americans, right, is, you know, let me back that up a little bit. What I mean is like, you see the same kind of dynamic that always concerns me, right? It's the same kind of way that we deal as a culture with things like slavery, right? Well, that's over. Well, that sucked. Move on, right? Or, oh God, we didn't give the women the right to vote. Well, they got the vote right. Solved, right? Civil rights happened. Everyone's got the right. Done, right? History is irrelevant, right? It's actually just the opposite, right? And right as the moment that we're reckoning with the legacy of white supremacy, right? The legacy of misogyny, the legacy of anti-racism, or of the racism and the deep racism in here, part of what we also have this opportunity to reckon with is that legacy of being like the top dog, so to speak, right? Of being kind of like, you know, at the helm of the empire. And then what do we do with that, right? And it's easy to say the U.S. did this, the U.S. did that. But we also have to be thinking about like solutions going forward. What are the kind of relationships that we want to build going forward here? And one of the, you know, you've probably heard me talk about this in the show before, but this is one of the things that one of the greatest social movement tragedies of 9/11, right? I don't mean like obviously the tragedy of 9/11 by itself, right? But I'm saying one of the effects that was happening right at that moment before the attacks is that we had this nascent global justice movement that was just getting formed, and it was messy, it was complex, it was all over the place, but there were these groups of people that were meeting on a global basis, right? You know, this kind of another world is possible. Right. This global justice movement. And it was like the kind of conversations is like, you know, if you got the UN or the top policymakers, these were folks that were coming for social movements. Right. And it got its start in Chiapas. Right. In Mexico. Right. Where you had the encuentros and then you had this kind of built into kind of policy frameworks and stuff. And it was like this moment, this glimmering moment of hope, where people were actually having constructive conversations about having the hard conversations about going forward. And it seems like we have that opportunity right now, right? One, we've got to take care of business and make sure that we kind of, you know, don't leave up loose ends. I mean, as the organization says, leave no one behind, no one left behind, right? I think that's absolutely the least we can do. But then actually, what do we go here and go forward? And how do we want to kind of do it in a productive way, which is not just sitting there and, you know, being the critic from the background, right? Or being the denier of history kind of on the other side. So I think we can do that. But anyways, look, yes, Emily said, say, we on the left, we have to be careful not to fall into purity tests. And I agree 100%. So great. Well, listen, thank you all for tuning in tonight. A little programming note on Wednesday of this week. I don't think that Cyril and I will be on together for the Wednesday show with Cyril Mikulenko. Hey, Seth, what's going on? He just kicked in. What I'm going to do instead for this Wednesday, if Cyril's able to make it, we'll kind of do a second show too as well. But I've got this little special Out to Coop podcast with saying, Kutztown University, a caring community, question mark. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about what's happening at Kutztown in relation to the pandemic and how a bunch of faculty members who are at serious risk of COVID-19, of having really detrimental effects if they catch the virus, part of surgery, about health issues and a whole bunch of other things like this. They were denied ADA requests. They were denied the ability just to work from home, right, and do an online year while the pandemic is still raging. And this has been an ongoing thing that Kutztown University has done. So I'm going to lay the ground a little bit for you on Wednesday. It's going to be a little bit of a shorter show. But then next week, I'm going to have a couple faculty members on who've had their ADA requests denied by the administration in a way that could put them in jeopardy. So now they're being forced to be treating, you know, keeping their job, right, or their health. And that is kind of like not the place you want to be. And as if readers of Raging Chicken and listeners to the show will know, this is not the first time they've done this kind of thing. So we'll talk a little bit about that on Wednesday. We'll be back again on Friday. On next Monday, I've got Kirsten Zolfo on, and she is the PA Indivisible Legislative Chair. She's also one of the people that works on the Members of Congress Tracking Report through Indivisible. We're going to have her on the show. She's based right out of here at Doylestown, I believe. And we're going to be talking about what's happening here in PA. And then the week after that, we're going to kind of broaden back out a little bit too as well. So everybody, thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Want to remind you that you can become a patron of this show by going to patreon.com/rcpress and become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Look forward to see you on Wednesday and throughout the week. And for, you know, everybody out there, you know, keep your nose to the grindstone, keep the organizing going, and look, a better future is possible, right? There you go. So Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. See ya! Let me try my people cow.
Where are my people? Wouldn't want to be ya.